You're listening to the Steve's Outdoor Adventures podcast, where we talk about hunting, politics, sports, and everything in between. Now, here's your host, Steve West.
Everybody, welcome to the Steve's Outdoor Adventures podcast. We've got an exciting show for you today. I've got a guest coming on with Travis and I. It is T-Bone Turner from the Bone Collector.
Nice. I'm excited for this one.
Dude, he is a badass individual. We're going to talk about some more, but you know, Travis just got a just got a really rough diagnosis last year. He had, you know, sarcoma, cancer in the lower part of his leg. Recently had his leg amputated just above knee. Now, T-Bone is one of the most recognized individuals in the outdoor industry.
For sure. Huge personality.
Yeah. I mean, this is Michael Waddell's buddy, Nick Munt's buddy. I mean, this is Bone Collector dude. Yep. He's an archery expert, incredibly uplifting, positive individual. And once again, he had to have his leg amputated, and the positivity has just never stopped flowing from him. His outlook on life is amazing. You know, and of course, today is also the day that the March Madness kicks off. I'm monitoring all my games. My
Duke.
They play tomorrow. My Blue Devils, got my Blue Devil water here. You know, I mean, in all seriousness, go Duke. My bracket's going to go unscathed. I'm going perfect this year. I know my bracket's going to be awesome.
I don't know about that.
Yeah. I'm in Jay Billis's group on the ESPN, brackets, and I'm going to kick his ass this year. This is my year to hit the brackets. But tell you what, we've got a Zoom link. We're going to bring in T-Bone right now, and let's get this podcast started.
Let's roll.
All right. Hey, we're back here at Steve's Outdoor Adventures Podcast Studio. And this week we've got a special guest, Travis T-Bone Turner from the Bone Collector Crew. And, you know, you've been at this a long time, kind of like me. What year did you start filming?
Well, I mean, full time, we started Bone Collector in like 2007, 2008. But I started doing stuff with Realtree and Jeff Foxworthy around 99, 2000. And then, you know, before that, I shot professionally. So I did get some. Every time you get kind of close to a podium or winning a podium, you got a little ESPN time in the early 90s. But hunting wise, I guess you could say started in 99 or 2000.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think you started just like two or three years before us. And you know, I remember seeing the videos and whatnot, the Realtree stuff and the Foxworthy the videos and whatnot. And
it shows that we're really, really old.
Yeah. Been around for a long time. I mean, Realtree Outdoors has got to be in like season 24, 25 now, isn't it?
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, well, I know Realtree, the pattern was established in 86, and they even go back to the TNN days long before there, you know, TNN and ESPN. And then of course, Outdoor Channel and Sportsman's Channel. So yeah, they've been around. Them and Jackie Bushman has been around forever.
Yeah.
They've been killing deer about as long as Bill Dance has been catching crappie.
Yeah, that's for sure. Now, you primarily bow hunt, don't you? Or do you get out to do a little gun hunting?
I'm known for, bow hunting. My background is archery. I just can't get enough of it. And, usually bow hunt mostly. But, man, if it's legal, we're for it. I mean, I like to smell some powder burn. And I've been doing a little bit more muzzleloader hunting here lately. And, you know, if they had a wrist rocket season, we'd be all for it. But yeah, but I'd say probably 65 to 75% of all the hunts that we do are usually bow hunting. But yeah, I know. I'm the older I get, it sure is nice to reach out there and tap 300, 400, 500 yards.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, get the long range bow out. Yeah,
yeah, so, exactly.
So you know, we've been talking about, not to cut you off, sorry, Travis, but I mean. You know, we talked a little bit before we started recording, you know, recently you had kind of a tough diagnosis and now you've got a little bit of a limitation. Tell us about that. Cause I just picked up on a little bit of stuff through social media. This is the first time you and I've had a chance to talk about it. Tell us what happened, kind of, you know, where you're at now and, you know, kind of how that looks going forward for hunting.
Yeah. I had a nodule pop up or a knot pop up on my shin. And I didn't think much about it. I had a hematoma from when I fell about 10 years ago on a stump. I just fell in some deep snow in northern Wisconsin, and I landed on a stump about the size of a Coke can, and it didn't puncture the skin or anything like that. It just caused a huge hematoma, you know, like I got whacked across the shin with a baseball bat. And I didn't think much about it. And the doctor told me when I got back home, he said, look, you're just going to have a hematoma. He goes, there's no blood clot, no nothing, nothing we can do. He goes, it's real invasive if we try to suck that out. He goes, it'll absorb back into your system. So fast forward 10 years down the road, right beside that, I get that little nodule that popped up. It's about the size of a grape. And I didn't think much of it. I'm thinking, well, looks like I'm getting older and, you know, my dad has had boils and cysts and stuff removed. And I thought, well, it's just a, this is just going to be a redneck episode of Pimple Popper. We'll get rid of that thing and all good. And I went to the doctor and it got aggressive. It was growing like it got to a golf ball size within a week. And then, you know, my primary care doctor said, look, that thing's pretty aggressive. We need to get that checked out. So I went to another friend of mine, my primary care doctor. He and I, he's a hunter and we've been friends for years, and referred me to another local doctor that's an internal medicine and a surgeon. And he looked at it and said, yeah, he goes, probably nothing. We'll just, you know, probably end up knocking it out, but let's run an MRI and see what we got. May have to do a biopsy. So he did an MRI, seen it was entangled all within my muscles, my ligaments, wrapped around the bone. It was all inside my leg. And he said, it's a lot bigger than what we're seeing. He goes, we're seeing some aggressiveness, but it's basically been growing and we haven't noticed it until now. It's wanting to go out. It ain't got nowhere else to go. So it's having to reach out, branch out. He says, we need to do a biopsy. And about the time we scheduled the biopsy, it busted through my skin. This is late September now. So it had busted. There was nowhere else to go. You know how you don't have much meat on your shin anyway. It busted through the meat. So now the tumor is growing on the outside of me, and it's growing. It's doubling in size nearly every week. So we do the biopsy. It takes 7 to 10 days for the biopsy report to come back. It comes back as fibrosarcoma, which is a very rare type of cancer. Only about 15,000 cases per year across the, you know, the whole country, or maybe even be worldwide. I just know there's only about 15,000 cases a year. They said it's real fast. It's real aggressive. Next place it moves, usually when it does move, is goes to the lungs. You know, it goes into the lungs. So we, you know, first thing I'm thinking is let's cut that thing off, you know. And I researched, me and my wife, we researched fibrosarcoma. About the only successful way to get rid of it is by surgery. Chemo is usually not real successful on it because it's not like within the organs. It's, you know, it's on the outside. It usually attacks the limbs, your arms. A lot of times people get them on their necks, on their shoulders, their arms, or their legs. And it's usually common within men, you know, 45 years and older. So we went to the Winship Cancer Center in Atlanta. We researched where to go, who's well-versed with sarcomas. We were real fortunate that the cancer center right here in Atlanta is really well versed in it. So we went there, the University of Emory, and they looked at it, absolutely agreed. It was extremely aggressive. We needed to start chemo. And the reason why they wanted to start chemo is because there's no need to work on your leg, operate on your leg, cut your leg off if you've already got it in your lungs or it's in your innards, you know, your vitals. So we did a CAT scan. I do have a nodule on my lung. It was 9 millimeters when we started. And they don't know if it is, you know, it's just a nodule, something to look at. It could be cancer. It could not be cancer. Won't know until we do a biopsy. But they said, we want to run you through a real aggressive type of chemo. And when they said aggressive, I just thought, you know, we all know people who have went through chemo where you go in for 3 or 4 hours, you're in an infusion, you come home, and then, you know, you feel like crap for 2 or 3 weeks, and then you go do another round. I thought it was going to be like that. They admitted me into the hospital. They was giving me 2 types of chemo for 5 days straight, not 3 or 4 hours and go home. I was in the hospital. They had to admit me to watch my vital signs because they were basically taking me to death's door and then bringing me back, because they wanted to slow the cancer down because it's so quick, and or, you know, stop it from being in my vitals. So I did that for 3 rounds all the way up till New Year's Eve. And we stopped the treatments then. And then the CAT scan showed that it did shrink the one. It had grown a little bit in my leg, but it had shrunk in my chest. So it went from a 9 millimeter down to a 6 millimeter. So we stopped the chemo. Now we know that everything's clear within my vitals, or, you know, so the CAT scan shows and the MRI. What we're going to do is amputate your leg now, because by the time we got to round 2 of the chemo, each one of the there was four tumors the size of softballs, or like portobello mushrooms, big, large, huge portobello mushrooms. Imagine taking four of those and gluing them around my leg, and that's how big they were. They were on the outside, out of my skin, growing, real grotesque, having to change bandages twice a day. So it got to that point, and we were having to do that twice a day. And I had to go 6 weeks after the last chemo treatment before we could do any amputation or surgery, because you have to let chemo get out of your body. February 7th was amputation day. So we amputated my left leg. The tumors had grew all the way up to my knee, the bottom of my knee. So there was no way to save anything from my knee down. So you have to bypass the knee, and now we're just above the knee. So they amputated, and that's where we've been since February 7th, is basically in, rehab. And I went to rehab for 8 days to learn how to, you know, get around the right, you know, I grew up, you know, as probably you guys did, you get a hurt leg, you just get on a set of crutches and you get around. But this day and age, they're anti-crutches. They're just saying it's too much of a safety hazard, and they want you on a walker, or my other transportation is a wheelchair. So I just got to let my stump heal. I'm just in a healing mode now. I went back to the Tuesday. I went back to the doctor. We did another scan. The nodule on my lung is at 5 millimeters now, but we don't know if it's going to calcify around it and it just be what it is. We don't know if it's cancer, or could it have some life left in it and it take off. So we've got an appointment with a thoracic surgeon in a couple of weeks to see about removing it. You know, it'd be real, if you're going to go in there and try to take a biopsy to see if it is cancer, may not even be, you might as well pull it on out, because it's only 5 millimeters. So that's one thing that we're looking at. We don't want that to get out of hand, as well as I'm still rehabbing on the stump. So next step would be, they've cleared me to get my shrinker. When you have a wounded leg, or, you know, my stump now, I'm always thinking it's going to look like a cone, but it ends up, it's more like a Subway sandwich sideways. There's no way I could set this thing in a prosthetic. It's crazy. So I've got to go get a shrinker. Everybody has to get a shrinker and a shaper, and you shape it into a cone. So next week I got an appointment to get this thing. It's healed up enough to where I can do so. So in the meantime, I feel good, as far as, able to do things. Like I've, you know, been working in my shop in my basement. You know, I can ride on my four wheeler. I've been shed hunting. I've been, getting out and about and fishing, but, I can't drive yet. It's my right leg, so I can't drive. So, a truck ride sure does seem nice to see some countryside. So, So I'm able to get out and about, but, just got to be real careful. You know, I can't, anytime you have a fall or anything, it, my size, my age, and with only one leg, it could be a setback. So I just got to be real careful. But we're, still positive, still got a great, great attitude. We've had a few days where we've had our lip poked out a little bit, but for the most part, we're doing pretty good.
Good. That's awesome. That's awesome. You were going to ask a question, well, Travis.
I'm going to kind of switch gears after hearing that. And, you know, it takes a lot of courage to share that story. So thank you for doing so. But I also saw when you officially announced it on social media, when you talked about what you're going through officially, and I'm getting a big dose of it now, is how are you able to stay so positive through getting difficult news like this? And then a second part to that question is, you talk about your team and who's around you, and you have this giant support system, and it's just really inspirational to hear both those sides. If you can share that for our listeners, I think that's really important for inspiration.
Well, I appreciate that. And yeah, you're right. I mean, the support, when I did the post, I kind of kept it a secret for throughout the whole fall. You know, I didn't travel much. People were asking, where's T-Bone? How come you ain't in Kansas? I got a farm in Kansas. How come you're not in Colorado? You know, the hunts that we would normally do, you know, I didn't travel any of this fall because of that. And people were asking, and we kept it to, I told about 15 or 20 people, and I said, please, please keep this under your hat. Not that I don't want people to know. It's just, we were trying to figure things out too, you know, ourselves. You know, I didn't know what I was going through. I didn't know what we were getting into, and I'm learning this whole time. And then plus, man, I mean, that chemo, I'm glad that I didn't think it was going to be much on the beginning, because had I known had I known what I was
going to say. It's that fourth podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. So had I known, you know, what I was fixing to go through, I mean, I would have been reluctant to it, or I had a lot more anxiety about going through it. So I'm glad that we just needed to focus as a core team. And, you know, I know that if something was to leak out or something, I didn't want people to, you know, have misinformation. And, you know, all of a sudden it becomes something like a Ferris Bueller's Day Off type thing, you know, where it's like, man, did you hear Ferris is dying? You know, and all Ferris had was some, you know, how you tell a secret and then 10 times down the line, it gets missed. So I'm like, there'll be a time. I know we're going to let everybody know. And I'm not, you know, I appreciate all fans or people out there I can't believe the outpouring that we've had, the amount of thoughts and prayers and, you know, the amount of people that, you know, sent their well wishes in and said stuff. I was floored at how many people, responded to that. But to answer your question about, it helped because I kind of knew that there was going to be an amputation even in October. You know, I mean, I knew that it was coming. So I had plenty of time to think about it. And then at the end of the day, you know, Michael and I've had this conversation all the time. No matter, let's just take cancer out of the equation. I mean, I felt this way about my life and or where I'm at long before cancer. Cancer just kind of accelerated or was a, you know, unfortunate reality check. If I never kill another cockroach, let's just take cancer out of it. If I don't ever kill another cockroach, I view myself as an 18 or 19 year old kid that didn't have two nickels to rub together. And to be able to do everything that I've done, I've way exceeded my dreams. You know what I mean? And there are so many people out there that would love to trade places with what we have all done or are doing for a living. So no matter how bad I've got it, you know, I'm 50 years old. At 50 years old, man, I've far outlived my dreams. And no matter how bad I've got it, someone's always got it way worse than me, man. I have zero complaints. And it's not like I'm not going to still be able to enjoy the outdoors. I'm still going to be able to enjoy the outdoors. My main concern is I want to be able to get in my skid steer, do land management stuff, get in my tractor, be able to fish a little bit, be able to shoot my bow, be able to hunt a little bit, and still have the gift of gab to chit chat with people and talk hunting and visit with friends. Cause at the end of the day, those are the things that are so important. You know what I mean? Just,
yeah.
Yep.
We lose focus. Sometimes we look so big and like, I got to do this, or I got to kill this, and my life's not complete if I don't get this, and I need this trophy room. And I got to looking at, this is long before cancer, but it really set home is, you know, you look at, and Steve, there's nobody's probably got as nice a trophy room as all the things that you've killed. I mean, unbelievable what your travels and, you know, and both of you guys, but let's just look at it. I'm just putting this in perspective. No matter who, we're so blessed to get to travel and do what we get to do. We're so blessed to get to be on, you know, be in the public eye or what have you, and be recognized or whatever. It's so blessed to touch so many people. And we're so blessed to be able to go to all these places that most guys only get to go on like two trips a year. Two trips in their life, period. As soon as we die, those trophy rooms are somebody's burden. You know, it means everything to us. I mean, so seriously, the day we die, my wife is like, what am I going to do with all this stuff? Like I was down in the bow shop working earlier this morning. I had to do a podcast for Peterson Bow Hunting, and I was down in the basement, and I've got basically as well a stock pro shop as most pro shops are around the country, you know, in my basement, just because that's what all I've done for the last 30 years. And I'm like, the day I die, this is somebody's headache. This means nothing to nobody but really me. I mean, there'll be some people that can appreciate it, but for the most part, it's like my wife is like, I'm going to have to spend 3 or 4 weeks down here getting rid of all this stuff. Because, you know, you know what I mean?
Yep.
So it puts things into perspective. You know, I know we're doing a podcast and we're doing it over Zoom, but let's just say we're sharing a campfire and the memories those mean so much more. You get so much more out of touching people's lives and being able to, if you're talking to someone, even though I'm sitting here with one leg, man, I'd like for you guys to leave this with a smile on your face. to value and cherish our time together. Not because I was here, but our time together.
Yeah.
And that's what makes life. But we get so focused on, you know, all the big things, the social media, got to get this trophy, man, I need this bow or this. And those are all nice as long as that ain't your core, that ain't your focus. So, I hope that kind of answers your,
yeah.
As far
yeah,
as
yeah, for no, sure. Totally, totally. I mean,
if you keep those as your value, the smile and the inspiration, it comes natural.
Yeah. Hey, Travis, we got to take a quick break. I hear from one of our sponsors, and when we come right back, we're going to continue this conversation about the things that are important and put some of this outdoor industry stuff in perspective.
This segment of the Steve's Outdoor Adventures podcast is sponsored by Marathon Seat Covers. We've got you covered.
All right, we're back here at Steve's Outdoor Adventures podcast studio, and we've got T-Bone, Travis T-Bone Turner here with us. And, you know, you were telling us about, you know, the things that are more important. Like, everything you were saying, I was relating to, because as we get older, we start to think about things like that more and more often. And one of the things I did last year was I didn't have any camera operators around. I had that tag from my own ranch here in Oregon where I've had it since 1998 and I've never killed an elk there. And I probably need to someday. I've always said I need another elk like I need a hole in the head. But yeah. If I was going to shoot one, I wanted it to be special. And so I did a couple of social media posts from the field up there, just kind of sharing like, hey, I don't even have any camera guys. But the one thing that I miss is that as we travel and hunt, we're always in camp with a bunch of other people, right? Sometimes it's people we don't even know. We're at a lodge. Maybe it's a bunch of guests, you know, and we share our time with those folks. A lot of them are fans and stuff. But I think the one thing that I've missed more than anything else is a hunting camp with friends, no camera guys. God forbid a camera guy show up if I ever get that environment where it's just cutting it up with friends, you know, and hunting. I haven't shot an animal off camera in over 20 years. I mean, yeah, you relate, right? I mean,
oh, I know. I totally get it. And it feels weird, actually, to be honest with you. I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm always the glasses half full type of guy. And I try to look at it as I enjoy that. I embrace it. It's not that we're complaining about that, because to me, it turns a me sport of hunting into a we sport, because if that cameraman can't capture it, you can't shoot it.
No.
So therefore, it turns it into, I mean, I'm glad to have somebody there, whether it's documented or not. It's just like instant hugs and
yeah.
High fives. It's like, we did it. We did it.
Yeah. You know, I get it. I was lined up on an elk and I turned around like I'm all by myself. I mean, I was completely alone. And I turned around and looked over my shoulder for somebody who wasn't there.
Yeah. Did you see that? Yeah.
I was like, oh, God. Yeah. He got away from it. I was like, okay, this is. It took me a minute to realize that I was alone. I was like, dang, you know, nothing happened. I didn't end up killing an elk up there. But at the same time, I guess I'm one of these days, I think the thing I look forward to the most is when the cameras are all gone, there's no more filming going on. I'll just be at camp, maybe with my brothers or friends or something like that. And we'll be just hunting. And like you said, you're out there hunting for what it is. Instead of hunting for entertainment, we're hunting for family, friends, you know, camaraderie. Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I know to add to what you're saying, we don't even have to hunt. Meaning like when I'm in Kansas, me and my buddy Pete have so much land there and there are other people hunting. I get as much fun as being basically an outfitter or guide, you know, like knowing I just want to be a part of the whole thing.
Yeah.
I don't have to be the bigger man. I just want to be the guy that like, oh, punk, I like to be your pump man, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, hey, in the truck, man, I'm fixing to drop you out, dude.
Yeah.
This standing hot. I can't. Oh man, I wish I could sit with you today. Or
yeah, look at the trail camera pictures. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. I absolutely love that. I am, it's killing me not to be out there shed hunting right now in Kansas. Cause you know, now's the time when they're all dropping. And last year we just had a phenomenal time. I mean, my favorite week of the year last year was spent out there just, you know, going over farms and spending daylight to dark, just either walking ditches or riding on the forward or just covering ground and picking up antlers, man. That was just, I loved it. And then we'd come back at night, we'd fellowship. There'd be a group of 8 or 10 of us and we'd cook a big steak dinner and, you know, sit around and just reminisce and man, and it, you're building sweat equity towards what's going to happen in the fall. You know,
yeah.
When you kill the animal, it's just, that's the pimple popping.
Yeah. So yeah. Steak.
you're building sweat equity and all that stuff. And it adds to the pride factor when it finally comes down. You know, there's nothing like killing a critter on your own ground and or having a little bit more into it. But yeah, you don't have to necessarily do it, but you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, totally.
You said you've hunted your land since 98.
Yeah, I mean, someday.
It's crazy how life experiences, especially when it has to do with health, really puts things into perspective, like immediately. All the, like you said, the material things or things that just don't really matter just go to the wayside in a heartbeat. And all of a sudden just people, relationships and family and, you know, things that really, really, truly matter are at the forefront of your mind. And that's all that matters.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some people chase trophies. Some people chase dollars. You know, Mark Zuckerberg and all these guys that's got all this unbelievably amount of money. It means nothing when you die.
Yep.
There ain't $1 million that can bring you one more minute on earth, period. When it's your time, it's your time.
Yeah.
Done.
Yeah.
We need to cherish it. And that's why I always try to promote smile, positivity. It, you know, people that are grumpy and treat people bad all the time, God, I feel so sorry for them. You know, it's
miserable.
Too short to go. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Travis was asking you a question, T-Bone, earlier, kind of like, who's in your inner support group? Like, who's around? Like, when this all went down, I imagine, you know, you've got your wife and your son, but you also had, like, I'm sure, like your boys, you know, Nick and Michael, yep, and whatnot. I mean, but who all's in your inner circle there that kind of helped you through this tough time in your life?
Yeah, Michael and Nick, of course, and the guys that, you know, work at Bone Collector, of course, you know, our producers and stuff, even though they are, you know, producers and I mean, not saying negatively, I'm just saying it's family.
They're part of the crew.
We're, you know, less than 10 employees. It is the crew. It absolutely, they might not have a camera shoved in their face, but man, we couldn't do it without them. And we've got to be so close, you know, spending time in a tree stand together. So those guys for sure. You know, my wife, of course, my dad, my mother is already, she's passed away, but my dad, my stepmother, my sister, and then my two cousins in Kentucky, or two of my cousins in Kentucky, I'm really, really close with. And then I got a group of about, I don't know, 5 to 10 friends that are really, really close. We've been close long before I was ever on TV. We've been lifelong friends. And, you know, you have that friend that you could call up. They don't want nothing from you. They just want to, they're your true friend. They don't want anything from you. And, you know, and I hope that they all know, and or a lot more than that, you know, you only let so many know, that I would do the same for them. And I'd like to think that I've been there for them and will be there for them whenever they need something. So,
yeah,
guys, it's just, I can't tell you how much value I put on that. So yeah, it means so much to see.
Yeah. There was something you posted a picture of your wife putting up a bird feeder outside your rehab window, yeah, right? Did that come with a pellet rifle, a gammo gun come with that one?
Gosh, you know, the only bad thing about that is she would have brought it in there, but those windows are sealed. They're not ones that can open. So I would have had to I would have had to hit it with the buttstock first before I could
shoot the squirrel. Yeah. So what I was going to ask earlier is there a story around how you received your nickname, or is it just more of the obvious?
That was one of my questions. How'd you get the nickname? How'd you get the nickname T-Bone?
Yeah. So going way back in 1999, I owned my own archery and outdoor store for years. I opened it in 94 and we ended up, I sold it in 2006 to a guy that had a larger store down the road. He did guns. He didn't do bow. And I kind of had everything archery wise sewed up. And rather than compete against me, he bought me out. So he bought me out in 2006 or seven. And in doing so, I had to work with him. And that was a transition because I was doing a lot of stuff with Realtree. And that's about the same time we started Bone Collector. But I started doing more stuff with them because in the 90s, I started doing all the bow work for the guys at Realtree, any celebrities they had, whether it be country music singers or baseball players or whatever. I told them, I said, look, I'm not saying I'm archery God. It's just, I want these people that are in the public eye to get started in the right place. You know, you have to have a good experience into archery, because we all know with archery equipment, you know, it's got to be tailor fit. You know, you see so many people get set up with too long a draw length, or the peep sight's too high. you know, I was seeing a lot of that on television and or magazine ads. You look at a magazine ad and you got a guy in there, you know, showing the latest and greatest new Hoyt bow, and you don't even have a peep sight in the string, and he's anchored back here. And it's like, anybody that knows anything about archery, it's like, golly, this is a setup picture. There's no validity to this picture. So that really bothered me. I guess that's an anal side of me. I told Realtree, I said, you guys are the premier, the top of the heap as far as videos and television production. I just want to let you guys know that I will facilitate you or be glad to help in any way I can. You know, I'm just right down the road. I'm 45 minutes from headquarters at Realtree. And we began a relationship there. I was good friends with a couple of them anyway. And then we became even better. Michael, David, Bill, all of them became good friends throughout the 90s. But if you go back, you know, a lot of the listeners are probably not even old enough to know this, but in the late 90s, on the Monster Bucks DVD, or it was VHS back then, VHS and DVD series, they broke up the just having, rather than having like 30 or 40 hunts on one tape, about every three hunts, they would have a archery shoot. And they'd have Michael, Nick, and Michael, David Blanton, and Bill Jordan shoot against each other, you know, kind of hamming it up, a 3D archery shoot, break up the monotony of just straight hunts, and then they'd lead into three or four more hunts. Well, then they incorporated Jeff Foxworthy. He was hunting with Realtree quite a lot, and they had did the Incomplete Hunter, which was a 3-series VHS, just nothing but comedy parodies about hunting. You know, back then you couldn't pull up stuff on YouTube and stuff. This was long before the internet, so it was real important to have that kind of stuff. So it was a camp hit. It was great around. It brought comedy to hunting. People was laughing about it, playing it in camps. Kids got it. Women got it. It broke up the monotony of having nothing but hunt. So they had comedy in there. Well, they wanted to incorporate. David was asking me. I was setting up the courses for them to shoot behind the scenes in the 90s because of my background as a 3D competitive archer. And he said, "Look, man," he goes, "we got to come up with something different. It's always been me, David, and Bill, you know, shooting." And I said, "What about this?" I said, "The comedy's going over good with Jeff Foxworthy and Willie and Billy." I said, "Why not have those two guys shoot against y'all and incorporate the comedy into the archery tournament, and then you can continue on?" He says, "Man, that's a great idea." Well, Foxworthy was all for it, but the other comedian, which he's a DJ out of, his name is Shane, I can't remember his last name, out of Nashville. He's not even a hunter. He's not against hunting, but he's not a hunter per se. And he said, "Man, I'd be out of my element on that." So then David said, "Well, what about you, Travis?" He goes, "What about you? Why don't you be a sidekick for Jeff?" And I'm like, "Well, I wasn't thinking nothing about being on camera. I was just like setting up the targets. I'm like, I'm just glad to be setting up bows, setting up targets, and I'm somehow affiliated with Realtree and the arrows yeah. that I fetch are pulling through critters all across this country. I mean, I'm like, hey, I'm done. Redneck stamp, I'm done."
Yeah.
So they said, "No, we want you to do it. You think you can come up with a real hit character, you know?" And the character that Foxworthy played was Willie, had fake Bubba teeth and, you know, hat sideways and, you know, all the his pant leg stuff down into the boots. So I come up with this character. I took old Whitetail Hunter. And if you're 35 years or older, you know what a Whitetail Hunter was, the bow to have in the late 70s and early 80s. So I had a Whitetail Hunter. I put a fishing rod and reel on there because you don't see that in hunting. And
yeah.
I had the Bubba teeth, and then I took a long fishing hat. You know how fishing hats have got them long bills? I took and cut a V on it. Because in true redneck fashion, a redneck is not going to turn his hat around backwards to shoot his bow. He wants to leave his hat straight and have that V so that the string could come back when he's coming to full draw. So I did all these things and built this character, and I showed David, and they said absolutely loved it. Foxworthy loved it and said, "You know, I'm thinking, man, I'm going to be on the Monster Bucks DVDs. This is 99. I cannot believe this. This is Monster Bucks 10. I cannot believe I'm fixing to be on there. So this is my 15 minutes of fame. I'm like, Mom, I've made it." So 5 minutes before we're starting to film, all the little spine takes and stuff for the archery tournament for the Monster Bucks, they said, "What are we going to call you? You know, like, we got Jeff's name's Willie. The Shane's name is Billy. And you're going to be a cousin or sidekick to Willie. We can't use Travis. That's got too much class to it. We got to have a hick name." And I never have been called that, not one day in my life. And this was 5 minutes before we were going to film. I said, "What about T-Bone? Because my name starts with T. T-Bone, and it's real short, easy to remember. I said, what about just call me old T-Bone? And they said, yep, that's it. And I'm thinking the whole time, I'm like, I'm going to be on this year's Monster Bucks. That's it. That's all. Go back to Fletching Arrows. Done. You know, I thought that was all it's going to be. And it was short, simple, easy. People took to it. You know, archers, true archers could, you know, they were basically dissecting me shooting, and they could tell that this guy has shot before. You know, he's not, you know, not just some guy that they got shooting up there. And everybody loved the comedy part of it. And, you know, then Realtree started using me more and more, and I would, you know, go do store appearances and stuff like that. But the name T-Bone stuck. So, I got really lucky. I kicked all them four letter nicknames, and now I got me a
hash mark. Yeah, there you go. That's, yeah. You know, it's, yeah, funny how they come around, right? I mean, it stuck, and yeah, exactly. It stayed as a TV personality for, you know, still to this day. Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting that intense of a story on it. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's cool. So let me ask you a couple questions about some of your friends and stuff when we come back from this break, because I got to tell you, you're surrounded by some incredible characters, and you guys have had such an incredible run with Bone Collector and a following of fans and whatnot that's just second to none on the planet. And for everybody else in television, we're just jealous as hell that you guys came up with such a kick-ass name. So when we come back from this short break, we got here for more of our sponsors. We'll get into that. We'll be right back.
This segment of the Steve's Outdoor Adventures podcast is sponsored by Bergara Rifles, where the people truly make the difference.
All right, we're back here in the podcast studio. We're at the table we call Clark, and we're talking to Travis T-Bone Turner. You know, right before we went to break, I mentioned this incredible thing that you guys created, you, Michael Waddell, and Nick Munt, thing called Bone Collector. And I guess, how did you guys come up with the name? And I mean, obviously the logo's synonymous. It's on your head right now. I mean, it's,
yeah.
When you guys launched that, I was just like, oh, I missed that one. Talk to me about that. How did Bone Collector come along?
Yeah. We all got our beginnings with Realtree. Michael had the, which you can probably remember this, seemed to me like, and I'm not just saying this because it's Michael and or Realtree, but it seemed like outdoor television changed when Michael had the show, him and Steve Finch come up with the concept of Realtree road trips.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was said it was a different kind of hunting show. You know, most all hunting shows up till then was pretty much cookie cutter, which was good. Nothing bad. It's just, man, they pumped it up when they hit Realtree road trips in 2003. It was a different type of hunting show. Michael and me and Nick were all good friends. We was working with Realtree a lot. We was good friends, all about the same age, very similar personalities, a brother-like friendship. And with that said, Michael was the host, and he had me and Nick on as guests a couple of times throughout, you know, the early 2000s. And then Michael left Realtree as an employee, although we're still really joined at the hip with Realtree, and much kudos to them for all their support. We left Realtree as an employee in 2007, started hosting a show for Gander Mountain. Took the money that he made from being the host gig for Gander Mountain and approached me and Nick and said, look, I want to start a show and a brand, and I want you guys to be a part of it. Because he was like, man, he was still doing road trips, even though he wasn't an employee, he was still contracted to be the host of Realtree road trips. And we were doing that as well. But now he's not an employee, so to speak. So he said, I want to start our own show, you know, of course, with Realtree's blessing and support. And he goes, I want you two guys to help me because, you know, between the Gander Mountain show, Realtree road trips, all these appearances and stuff like that, I just can't do it. But, man, I just think there's a story to be told. And, you know, it's basically going to be a Realtree road trips, you know, a phase two, basically, is what we're going to start. I said, yeah, man, it took me about 2 seconds to answer.
I'm in.
Yeah, I just had to, you know, I believed in Michael. I believed in Realtree, and I believed in, you know, what we had going on. And plus, I just had sold my business. So I was in the seeking for the next chapter of what was going to happen in T-Bone's life as well. And it worked out perfect. I mean, just timing was perfect. So the way the name became, Michael's up in, this is before we started the show, Michael's up in New England at Thompson Center, and they were wanting to do a signature series muzzle loader. And they wanted to do the Michael Waddell signature series because of road trips and his popularity, and wanted to do it. And he said, man, I really don't want to do a signature series. I'd rather do it like, something different. But they never come up with a name. But he shot it. He said, listen, we're going to do some type of name signature series. This is going to be the one you shoot mostly. He goes, what they said is you shoot all these muzzle loaders, and whichever one you like, you know, that's the one we'll tag your name with it. And this will be, you know, the Pro Series, Michael Waddell Pro Series. So with that said, he shot them all and he got to that Triumph, shot the Triumph motor. And, you know, and just in true redneck fashion, like we always got some saying, he goes, man, I don't know about the rest of these muzzle loaders, but this one right here is going to be a bone collector. And that, you know, like going to collect the antlers. And he said,
there it is.
Dang, like instantly it just hit him. He's like, man, that's going to be the name of our show. I don't know if it's going to be 2 years, 3 years, but that's the name of our show. He called us. He was in the airport leaving Thompson Center and says, guys, man, I got the name of our show, Bone Collector. That's what we're going to do, Bone Collector. That's going to be the name of it. Well, instantly, I thought of the movie with Denzel Washington. I said, we'll never get that name. I said, you know, if Hollywood's already latched onto it, they've got it. Well, they didn't have it protected whatsoever. They didn't protect that name. It was free and clear, other than there was a knife maker in, don't hold me to it, Pakistan or Iraq or something like that. There was a knife maker, and we ended up buying it for, I want to say, $52,000. We had to buy the name so we'd have international rights to Bone Collector, and we got Bone Collector. And then the design is Michael was just kind of spitting out some stuff to a college kid over in Alabama, and he drew this. So it wasn't like we went and spent thousands and thousands of dollars, and it came back. This was even before. And he says, you know what? He goes, I want to incorporate that. He goes, I never understood, because we're known as whitetail hunters primarily. I mean, we hunt everything, but I'm like, Michael, that's a mule deer all day long, dude. I said, it don't matter. It's got the skull in there. It works out perfect. Yeah. So it's recognizable. It's simple, you know, a lot of like the Browning buck mark or what have you. So it's real flattering. Like every time I see the Bone Collector sticker on the back of a window, it really does, you know, it's real humbling and appreciative. So that's how we came up with Bone Collector. And we figured me and Michael always still have that. We call it the Plan B discussion. We always think that about every 2 or 3 years, this is going to be the end of it. Man, we have a good run. Hopefully somebody will hire me to fletch arrows in their shop, you know. And then Michael, like, yeah, me and my dad can still run some drywall. I'm sure I can, you know, scratch out a living the rest. So it's been real humbling and appreciative to get to where we're at.
Yeah. I mean, this is my stronghold, my own hometown, and half the damn trucks around here have you guys' logo on their back window.
So you've had obviously you've had a really decorated career as an archery, in archery and just in general, right? And I think I read on your bio, you won a world championship competition in 1991. But was there a time in your life, or if you think back, when was that one moment you realized I could actually do this as a career, whether it's on TV or just as a pro, you know, on a pro staff somewhere? Or just, was there a defining moment in your life you're like, yes, I can move forward and actually do something with archery?
Well, I tell everybody this story, you know, the story of how I got started, meaning I worked for Mercedes-Benz in Atlanta, in high school and out of high school. And I wasn't very good in school as far as like, I mean, you know, I wasn't a bad kid. I was a good kid. It's just, man, I just was so focused on hunting and fishing. And, I'm looking back now, I would say I'm self-diagnosed with ADD. I have no attention span whatsoever. Meaning like it's all I can do to read a magazine article without my brain going somewhere else. So it's no wonder I didn't do too good in school. So I worked for Mercedes-Benz, loved that, was driving to Atlanta, which was, I lived in the suburbs outside of Atlanta for about an hour and 15 minutes away from there. So I had to go to Atlanta every day to work. And the traffic was killing me. I'm not a city boy. I don't want to work downtown. Working for Mercedes-Benz was good, but you know, you're still trying to figure yourself out. It's kind of crazy. you're asking these kids to graduate high school and they're supposed to decide what they're going to do for a living. And you're going to spend a lot of money trying to do so, chasing whatever you think. And honestly, most kids before they're 25 don't know what they're going to do for a living.
Yeah.
So you're going to go down a path in college of chasing a degree to be a doctor or a lawyer or something like that. And you don't even know what you want to do. And there's so many people that get stuck in a job. They either get stuck in debt with college, and then they're forced to work in that division just so that they can pay off their debt, or they end up working in an area where they don't even like and they hate their job. But they're so stuck responsibility wise, whether it be being a parent, married, a mortgage and all that, that they have to continue. They can't chase their passion. So I always tell people, pursue your passion, no matter what it is. You'll never feel like you worked a day in your life. So it took me a little while to get to that point. I'm telling you this because while I worked at Mercedes-Benz, I said, I got to change. So I went to school to be an HVAC mechanic. So I was going to work outside. I'm like, that's something I see something every day. Everybody's always going to need heat and air. I'll work in that field. And most outdoorsy type guys do that kind of stuff. I said, that's what I'll do. I can always make good money and living. So about the time I'm going to night school, it took me 2.5 years to get my degree. And about the last 2 months, all this time I'm shooting archery as well and loving the outdoors. I mean, I wanted to be a professional fisherman until by the time I graduated high school. I hunted, but I just squirrel hunted and rabbit hunted and stuff like that. A little bit of deer hunting in high school. I didn't really start deer hunting and stuff heavily or get addicted to it till after high school. About the time I'm graduating to get a HVAC certification, I'm like, I do not want to do this the rest of my life. I'm like, and I felt like such a failure. I'm like, I've wasted all this time, all this money. I got a degree in HVAC. Nick always says this. He goes in seminars when we tell that story, says, yeah, T-Bone's got a degree in HVAC, and the only unit he's ever pulled is his own. So with that said, I never worked in it. So I continued working for Mercedes for a little while longer, and then I won the world championship, and I just loved archery. I mean, I was spending 40, 50 hours a week working on archery stuff after my job. I mean, I could not get enough of it. If I was awake and I wasn't at work, I was doing something with archery. I just, because if competitive archery is a lot like golf, but yet it's a lot like NASCAR too, because you're always working on something and building a better mousetrap, but you got to suppress that nervous energy and work on yourself as well. But I just could not get enough of it. And I got offered a job to work in an archery shop a lot closer to home. It was going to take about a $10,000 or $15,000 a year pay cut. But I said, I'm going to do this. And the reason why is because my dad and my uncles had always said, if you work, do something that you love, you never feel like you worked a day in your life. And I'm like, I'll be closer to home. I won't have to deal with the traffic. I'll be working on bows and arrows. I'll be gaining the sponge-like information. And I'll be celebrating with all my outdoor buddies, getting them ready to go to the woods and telling hunt stories. And man, that was the best decision I ever did. So I worked in an archery shop for about 2 years. And even though I could do that, I said, now's the time to do that because I don't have a mortgage. I still lived at home in my early 20s. I didn't have a wife. I didn't have kids, and I could afford to do that. I'm like, now's the time to take that chance. You can't wait till you're 32 years old and you already got wife, kids, and everything like that. You can't jeopardize them. I said, now's the time to do it. So I did so, and I'm so appreciative. I mean, it's crystal clear in hindsight, you know what I mean? But at the time, it was scary. It was absolutely scary to do so. So I took a chance and started working in the outdoor industry, and I haven't looked back since. You know, each door opens, and when we opened my own store in 94, I'm telling you, there were some humble times. I moved way far south of Atlanta to where the best hunting and fishing was, but it put me in the place to be next to Realtree, so another door opened as far as that goes. But I'm telling you guys, you can work 3 or 4 days and sometimes of the year in an outdoor store, and the cash register rings only $100, and you're making $16,000, $17,000, $18,000 a year. It's you got to be passionate to continue on. I'm not complaining because things finally caught traction and things worked out, and I wouldn't be where I'm at now if I wouldn't have endured those years like that. But it didn't matter. I was doing something that I loved, and I didn't dread. I didn't slam my head into a pine tree every day dreading going to do a job I didn't want to do.
Yeah. So let me ask this, where you live now, do you live anywhere near that infamous place called Booger Bottom?
Yeah. I'm 30 minutes from there.
Is there actually a place called Booger Bottom? Is that some place that Michael created?
No. It's an actual place.
No kidding.
It's an actual place. Yeah. It's not incorporated, but it's known as anybody within, an hour of here knows it's Booger Bottom. And the reason why is because it was called the Cove, and it was a wrap in the river of the Flint River. And it was a cove, and down on the river back in the day, a lot of guys would go down there and they were making moonshine. They were steel and stuff like that. And there was only one way in, one way out. And they called it Booger Bottom because it's lower lying land compared to this is the very end of the Appalachian Trail. So the Appalachian Trail is the last of the mountains, ends right here. It goes all the way to Maine. So it ends right here with us. But there's mountains around the Flint River, but in that bottom, it was all bottom land. So they called it Booger Bottom because, urban legend was you go down there and the boogers will get you. Well, the boogers are the people making steel. You go down there sniffing around their steels, they'll shoot you down. And it's like, it's haunted / the boogers will get you down there. So they called it Booger Bottom.
I thought maybe it just got that name from Michael being up to his first knuckle or something.
Yeah, exactly.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. And that would be a bad story.
Yeah, it would be. And then how far away from you does Nick live?
Nick's in Minnesota.
He's in Minnesota? I thought he was in South.
No, he's from South Dakota. He's from Spearfish originally. Nick didn't get married till just 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Nick's always been single. Well, Nick's wife now is from Minnesota, and she has two kids with her first husband. And, to raise the kids, has to stay in Minnesota. So he moved down here for about 3 or 4 years. He bought a lake house and renovated the lake house. And he lived here for about 3 or 4 years. But during the time that he bought the house down here, he met her, and he's been living in Minnesota for probably 3 or 4 years now. And they just got through last year building.
I saw that. Yeah, the house.
Yeah, they call it. Well, they call it a rent. He calls it a renovation, but it's basically like he had a small farmhouse that they wanted to keep, and they basically did a huge renovation and tripled the size of it out the back. So he basically built a huge house onto that little farmhouse, blended it all in. Really neat deal.
Cool. Yeah. Well, we got to hear from one last sponsor, take a quick break, and we come back. I want to talk to you about something you and I have in common with regards to habitat projects.
Okay. This segment of the Steve's Outdoor Adventures podcast is sponsored by Burris Optics. Find what matters.
3, 2. Everybody, we're back here in the podcast studio. Travis Price and I are on here with Travis T-Bone Turner. We've been talking about life, hunting, Booger Bottom and a bunch of other stuff. And T-Bone, something I've seen you doing a lot is like land clearing, like thinning and, opening up food plots and projects. That's something that I like to hear. We have totally different landscapes. I think you work with New Holland, or who are you working with?
Yeah, New Holland, Bush Hog, as well as Vail.
Vail
has land with me, yes.
Yeah, we work with Bobcat, very similar skid steers and mini excavators and stuff. And we have, elk property, we got pine and fir and not pine like you guys, but like really different forests. I mean, you've been out west and it's just different. Sure. But one thing we learned was that if we didn't start doing some things with the ranch up here, it was going to be bad. We're having a lot of fires out west, Western Wildlife fires. Unhealthy forest. It was time to open up. So I started doing these habitat projects. And about time I started doing that, I started seeing you doing the same thing. What got you started doing that?
I mean, it hasn't been documented, but behind the scenes, we're real fortunate to get to hunt, archery, rifles, archery and all is a part of our everyday gig. And which is, it's a hobby turned career / passion, So we're real lucky in that respect. But I have always, I've been held back by the wallet or the checkbook, so to speak. But I've always been a fan of land, wanting land and stuff. So I bought my first piece of land in 1999. I bought 27 acres here in Georgia, which I know that don't sound like much, but trust me, with where I was at in life, that was big. I was like, what in the hell am I thinking about? Man, me and my first wife lived in a single wide mobile home. It was a 1,000 square foot on this property. And you know how us guys are, we'd rather have acreage as square footage. You know what
Yeah.
I would want more acreage, but nonetheless, I bought 27 acres. It was rough as a cob. And I took my four wheeler that I'd had. I bought a brand new four wheeler in 1993, and I was cutting stuff. I'd cut stuff by hand, I'd pile it up, wrap a chain around it, drag it off, cut stuff by hand. So trust me, I cut my, you know, clearing this and getting it ready. I didn't have a tractor. I didn't have a front end loader or anything like that. So my dad had a tractor on a lake house over in Alabama. It was a 28 horsepower Massey. And he's like, man, he goes, we sold our place over there. We got to have some place to keep that tractor. You want to keep it down there? I'm like, heck yeah. So we brought a 28 horsepower Massey Ferguson down here. And you wouldn't believe all the clearing I did with that, with a 5 foot bush hog and a Massey Ferguson. I mean, it's basically a lawnmower is what it was. It was a lawnmower on steroids. But I have always had a passion for, you know, clearing, grading, diesel therapy, anything to do with a tractor, skid steer, track hoe. And luckily, fortunately, I've bought several tracts of land out in Kansas and Oklahoma and Missouri. And, you know, I bought them, we fixed them up, sold them. I've just got the one big, nice track in Kansas right now, but I've added to what I have here. And I bought my track of land because it's next to a 2,100 acres of private land that I know it's a foundation property that won't never be sold. So if I can't afford 2,100 acres here in Georgia, because it's so, you know, it's an hour outside of Atlanta, you want to be a neighbor to that. You know what I mean?
Oh,
so
yeah.
With that said, I bought the 27 acres and we added to it, and we're right at 100 up against it now, all contiguous here. So in doing so, I just can't get enough of it. My wife says, you're off work for a week and you're going to spend it all the time in that skid steer doing stuff. And I'm absolutely, there's not a place I'd rather be is in there. It's just so, I guess, like I told you earlier, I'm ADD. I can sit in that skid steer. I can really not really think too much and work 8, 9, 10 hours and stop and look how productive I've been. And I feel so much better because it feels like therapy that I just went through. I mean, I just went through a recharging of the batteries type thing. But, and then to know all the good things that I'm doing are decisions for the conservation and, or, you know, I'm not going to say forcing, but changing the deer's patterns to be conducive to getting shot in daylight.
Influencing. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
You're influencing them to move places you want them to be. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, since, I get it.
Oh, since I knew I was going to get amputation and had cancer, my number one focus, I mean, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of things, but if, you know, out of the obvious, the selfish things, it's like every day I wake up, how can I get in that skid steer? You know how you got to climb in there. I'm like, I know I can't do it right now. And I'm going to figure it out. I'm getting in that skid steer. If you got to melt me down and pour me in there, I'm getting in
there. Get you a swing harness. Get your wife to run an excavator, put you in a swing harness and
get you in there,
lift you up and put you over there. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. We may have the first skid steer with T-tops and I'll just come in from the top.
Yeah. So speaking of conservation, are you still involved in places like Whitetails Unlimited or anything that you want to share with everybody?
Yes. Still been with Whitetails Unlimited. I want to say 8 or 9 years now, doing a lot of the banquets. They do 650 banquets across the country, mainly, you know, of course, east of Mississippi, but a lot of conservation banquets. And, you know, before COVID, I was doing about 35 or 40 of those events a year in certain areas. So, yeah, still heavily involved with them, real proud of that organization. But I support all conservation groups, meaning like, you know, it's like, you know, you ask me if I'm a bow hunter. Well, that doesn't mean I'm not a rifle hunter. It just means like that might be my number one checklist, but I'm all for anything legal. And the same thing with conservation, huntersnation.org, NRA. I just did a podcast yesterday with the Sheep Society out of British Columbia.
Yep.
And I was like, guys, you want to do a podcast with me? And I've ever killed in the sheep range is an Audad. So the poor man's sheep, but nonetheless, I'm all for all of it, because at the end of the day, we think that we as hunters is a great big group, kind of small, and we're being picked on here lately.
Yep.
Yeah.
So we do need to stand together, even if there's no sheep in my future at all, I'm all for protecting the hunting of the sheep rights.
Yeah.
Yep.
Let me ask you this. Out of all the hunting you've done in your life, I mean, and you know, I know you've done quite a bit hunting. I think, you know, you've hunted definitely and gone on a lot more trips than, like you said, a lot of folks would be happy to go on one or two trips in their life, and you and I have done hundreds, you know. What's the one thing, I mean, given your new limitation, so to speak, what's the one hunt you'd like to do? Even though you don't need to kill another cockroach or deer, nothing, rest of your life, what's the one hunt that you wish that you'd like to do once before you're all done, before you throw in the towel?
Well, naturally, I still want to. I want to be involved with whitetail. I like whitetail so much because they're so diverse and they're in so many different states. Everybody in this country can relate to them. No matter if you're in Florida, you know, Oregon, wherever, you know, there are whitetails, and somebody can relate to them. And I like that they're like a fingerprint. Everyone's different, you know, so you never know what's popping out. But I answer this question on a lot of podcasts and or interviews long before even cancer was a part of it. But really, I've killed an elk, I've killed mule deer, I've killed, you know, just about everything. The only thing that I wanted to kill, or that was on my bucket list, was a Yukon moose with a bow. I wanted to do that. And the reason, you know, I don't know that that'll ever happen. And I don't know that, you know, if it doesn't happen, I'm totally, totally fine. But, you know, me being the archery penetration, FOC, you know, studying all that and the penetration and all that, man, I just wanted to see my arrow cut loose and just sink right up in the vitals right behind the shoulder of a Yukon moose. I mean, I can imagine doing something like a float plane trip, you know, a float down the river, and you know, the all the ones I did want to kill a Yukon moose. I had an opportunity one time to get a tag in Maine for a moose up there, but I want a big Yukon moose. So that would be the one thing. A grizzly bear, a brown bear. I mean, don't get me wrong, I would do those. I've never been to Africa. And we're talking about doing that, but, honestly, I don't even have to go to Africa. Honestly, I'm fine with that. I'd like to do a Yukon moose, but if all I ever got to do was, you know, drop people off in Kansas and on some hunts, and I might volunteer for an outfitter or something like that, and, you know, just be the camp clown / dropper offer or pep rally guy. I'm so blessed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and you know, I love to hear that, you know, the moose, because there's, I mean, yeah, you want to see the arrow sink up in the moose, but when you do a moose hunt like that, the adventure is so much bigger than even the hunt, you know, the float plane ride into the backcountry, or the Super Cub to a gravel bar, to see the landscape and everything, and then to be around the animals is all, you know, pretty awesome. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we do, you know, is book these trips and stuff. And I wanted to know what that was, because if the opportunity ever came along, a Yukon moose ever came along, I want to know, because if I hit you on the speed dial, I'm like, yo, T-Bone, something come up. Oh. Yeah, what you got going on? And if God willing, health, you know, maintains and continues to improve and you heal up and whatnot, and something like that comes along, I wanted to know, you know, because like I said, I tend to pick up the phone and call my friends when things come available. So
I appreciate that. You know, and Michael's always, you know, Michael's always pushed me, just because I've been a bigger guy, I don't push myself as much as Michael would want me to push myself. Meaning, like, you know, I should do more elk hunts or do more mule deer. But the reason I haven't is because I don't have a problem going on my own dime and or going myself and letting myself down, because I can get a lot out of a hunt, even though I might not do it. But going for the show, I've always told Michael that I've always felt I don't want to let the show down, because I realize it's a business. I don't want to commit to something that I'm going to be horrible at, or, you know, it's going to be a failure. So
yeah,
I've always told him that, you know, I don't want to bite off more than I can chew. And I don't want to be a negative asset to, or negative liability to Bone Collectors and stuff. So I'm like, you know,
yeah, I know what you're saying, you know, 'cause I'm a bigger guy myself, but at the same time, I think about it from like a marketing standpoint for me, that like, if I, if I was to take you someplace like in a lake or river bottom where the moose come to rut and whatnot, and you stick a big old bull moose with an arrow, that'll inspire other guys that are like you and I, that are big dudes, you know, and let them know that, hey, this is something that's attainable and it's doable. And whether, you know, I don't know. I just, like I said, I think there's a lot of people. I did a mountain goat hunt in 2014, and I probably got like 1,000 emails from people over the years saying, man, I watched you go up the side of that mountain. And granted, I was coming off like a stone sheep hunt and like a couple others, and I was in pretty good shape going on that one. But we got to the top of the hill and killed this mountain goat and came down off this vertical slope. And I had guys email me saying, dude, you're a big guy. You were up and down that mountain. I think I can do that now, you know. And
well, I still get that on the phone.
Yeah.
Like even last week.
Yeah. I mean, you and I – being big guys can inspire other big guys to say, hey, I'm going to push past my little comfort zone and go for that, you know, and try to do, like you said, they're not necessarily worried about letting down a camera guy there, but it'll at least give them a chance to test their limits and push themselves someplace they wouldn't otherwise go.
If they really, really want to go. And yeah, and I was going to say, you've been an inspiration to me. I know I'm quite a bit bigger guy than you, and you're in a lot better shape than I am, but I'm just saying, you've been an inspiration to me. I'm like, man, Steve's getting it done. He's out there pounding them hills. And the times that I have went, you know, on elk hunts and mule deer hunts, and we filmed it and such, you know, it's always been real inspiring, and everybody's, you know, kind of pulling for me for sure, like the underdog and stuff. And it's been real rewarding. It's just, I hate for people to want you to do that and or go for you to do that, and then I don't want to let them down. If that makes sense.
No, I know exactly what you're saying. If an opportunity arises and we're able to go do a moose hunt or something, be no pressure. Zero.
I appreciate it. At this point in time, I'm just day to day, you know, and once I start hobbling around on a prosthetic and, you know, gaining some more confidence and stuff like that, but you fall a couple of times at the stage that I'm in right now, and it's real humbling, really big time. It's like, whoa, you know, even as a big guy, I got around pretty dang good. And then all of a sudden that's been changed in the last 6 weeks. So
yeah,
I'm really going to eat some humble pie on a daily basis. But hey,
you're getting a prosthetic though, right?
Oh yeah. Absolutely. Start next week.
I'll tell you right now. So I've had guys out to my ranch here in Oregon that were on prosthetics. I do a lot with wounded vets. And I had a guy named Larry Drone out one time. He had a prosthetic leg. He'd had it blown off in an IED explosion in Iraq. And anyway, we've got this elk coming in. Here are the buglings coming. Everything's happening and going down around us. And I was getting ready to reach over and hand him the shooting sticks. That dude pulled off his prosthetic leg, flipped it up on its end, and put his rifle over the top of his boot and had a rest.
Dude, that's awesome.
Yeah. Remember that.
Might need it, yeah.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, it's like a portable rest, right? Like a portable gun rest. It's good to go. So
Yeah, exactly.
All right, before we run out of time in today's podcast, T-Bone, I got to know, when are you going to drop the next big lip sync song?
You know, I need to do that. A lot of people have been asking for that. I might do that. I was thinking about doing something today because it's St. Patrick's Day, but we need to do that. Yeah, I don't need to stop doing that. I'm thinking it's silly and corny and stuff, but I think a lot of people like that.
Dude, I'll tell you what, you've got nothing on those guys that do it on, who's the TV that does the late night show that's always lip syncing and air drumming?
Fallon? Jimmy Fallon?
Yeah, Jimmy Fallon. He's got nothing over on you, dude. When you post those, I watch them, I share them to my wife. I mean, you got to get us another one, man. I live for seeing those pop up.
I'll do it. We need to start it on at least a bi-weekly thing.
At least.
Today's lip sync, it comes to you from Tillamook Cheese.
Nice.
Well, T-Bone, man, it's been awesome having you on the show. Tell the boys I said hello. We all got to catch up sometime, share a campfire.
Sounds good, man. Thank you guys so much. Keep up the great work. Thank you, Travis. Appreciate everything.
Yep, nice chatting with you.
Hey, man. Blessings. Take care.
Absolutely.
Man, that was pretty cool having T-Bone on the show.
Very much.
Yeah, he's inspiring.
For sure.
I mean, if somebody came to me and said, hey, Steve, you just had your update. You've got cancer in your leg. We're going to have to cut it off above the knee. I don't know that I would take it as good as T-Bone.
Yep. There's a lot of different directions you can go with that mentally, right? Or just whatever. And he's gone the positive direction by a landslide.
Yeah. He's got a great support system. He's got lots of great friends. Yeah. But yeah, to honestly say that he is an inspiring individual. He was inspiring before because he really has always uplifted people around him. I've had a lot of people tell me, oh, I was thinking about doing this, I was thinking about doing that, and I didn't think I could do it. And T-Bone told me, if you ought to try it, you know, do this, you can accomplish that. He's got that positive mental outlook on everything he always has, and it just carried right over. I mean, get cancer diagnosis, going to whack off your leg, no problem, man, we're going to roll, you know. Let's do it. Let's get it over with and see what the next chapter is. And like I said, I don't know that I've got that in me. I don't know that I have it in me. I guess I'd have to find out, and God willing, I never have to, but yeah, something else.
I agree. But he's definitely, you can even tell before he was diagnosed with cancer, he's got the right outlook on life and what's most important around him and his family and his, you know, his circle and what his goals were. And he kind of mentioned that, you know, pre-cancer is already here, and this was just kind of icing on the cake for me of what was most important. So it's almost like he had everything kind of figured out before that, which makes a huge difference.
That game face.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. Well, folks, we appreciate you joining us today on the podcast, listening in. Like I said, we had Travis T-Bone Turner on, and that was just, it was somebody I'd wanted to have on the show for a long time. And then as soon as we saw the cancer diagnosis and he had the leg amputated, I just had to have him on. There's no doubt about it. And I thank you, Travis, if you're listening to this. Appreciate you coming on the show with us today. So, got another guest coming up real soon. I'll spring a little surprise on you at a later date. But we're working on an important podcast. We're going to talk about some things. We're going to talk about that caribou. We're going to talk about the Boone and Crockett Club. We talk about Eliminator Laser Scopes and some other stuff that all kind of come together in one big story. And hopefully we'll be able to put that podcast together in the very most immediate future. So until then, everybody stay safe, get outside, have a great time, and enjoy the outdoors.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
The Steve's Outdoor Adventures podcast is sponsored by Farwide, the game-changing free app that puts outdoor intelligence in the palm of your hand.